Welcome to another edition of Gamers Footnotes. S is added, and our web address, as always, is still gamersfootnotes with the two S's .com, and our email address is gamerfootnotes@gmail.com. And I'm your host JT, along with my co-host.
I'm Steven. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming along with us on our semi-pretentious thoughts about gaming.
And today we'll be exploring our semi-pretentious thoughts in our series of Games as Art. And this week we're going to discuss in detail about sounding games, a very important feature of games, and which is often overlooked and considered sort of a add-on. And then a little bit later in the show, after we talk about that, we're going to discuss our little mini topics. And this week, I'm going to talk about the Massively article about rating less and living life more.
I'm going to discuss Steam as a distribution system a little bit. So you have that to look forward to if you're not as interested in sound. But stick around for the whole show. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yes, and definitely stick around for the whole show because there may be prizes. And by prizes, I mean there will be no prizes. And so I want to start off our issue about sound by asking Steven a question of what is the most memorable gaming sound that you can remember?
Gaming sound. Well, I'm going to take that question literally, and I'm going to not go with a soundtrack, but with an actual in-game sound. And it is the most memorable for me will definitely be the noise chocobos make as they are standing around in fields, often spelled K-W-E-H, Quay, because I use that sound in text messages not infrequently. I'm sort of a weird guy. I'll ask you the same question. Do you have a most memorable sound, a sound that defines games for you?
The one for me is actually the BFG from Doom.
Ah, yes.
Because the first time I heard that and that it made that sort of crackling sound and then exploded out towards the cyber demon, and then he still lived because I had to shoot him 3 more times with said BFG, it just sort of resonated as in a moment where the sound actually transformed the action, because it was like shooting at any of the other guns, but you had a sense of the almighty power behind the BFG that I think kind of became quintessential to sort of that Doom experience. And even further, all the sound effects in Doom really added to the ambiance of the game.
And I think kind of the way I see it, there are a couple of different categories of how sound is used in games. And one is what you just talked about, ambiance, sort of sounds that contribute to the theme. A second is sounds that are, well, or maybe a subpart of ambiance, or sounds that have to exist. I'll discuss that in just a second. And then kind of a whole separate category are sounds that are used as elements of gameplay. And my quick examples before, you know, if we talk about those a little bit more, an ambiance sound that we sort of have that's mandatory, lightsabers sound a certain way when they are drawn. If you go through every Star Wars movie, every Star Wars game, when a lightsaber comes out, that humming noise is in itself iconic. It has to sound that way because we won't accept lightsabers, of course, are literally tricks of light. I mean, they're either computer pixels or they're edited in. They're not real things. And so the sound is what sells us on the illusion. An example, and we can talk about this later, my quintessential example going back to an off-used Gamer's Footnotes trope is Dead Space, and the way sound is used to either direct or misdirect attention. Other examples, BioShock, especially the survival horror games, sound is used as a gameplay element. It's used extensively as a gameplay element, either as the misdirection to keep you from looking where you really ought to be looking, or to, you know, cause you to turn around and realize that something's been creeping up behind you. And so those are sort of different ways to approach sound, but they're both very important because they both establish the game universe in some way or another, either through more direct gameplay elements or through sort of sounds that we need to accept the universe and to enhance that suspension of disbelief.
And I definitely agree with that. And one of the things is, I think one of the problems Doom 3 suffered from is that the sound effects didn't really add to the experience. Because in Doom 3, you often was sort of a precursor to Dead Space in a way, which is more of, I think, Dead Space looked at it and was like, we could do this, but better. Is that you had the monsters in the closet, which was often the made fun of thing of Doom 3. And part of it was, as Steven talked about, that something has to sound a certain way. So Doom had already established what imps should sound like. what the monster growl should sound like. And Doom 3 completely went away from that, and I think the sound effects and the changing of that did more to take the gamer out of the experience rather than absorb him in, which created a disconnect to point out other things that are wrong. And it's one of those things of human nature that once you sense one thing is wrong, you then attempt to figure out what exactly is wrong. It's one of those fancy survival traits we have of something is amiss, and I'm not sure what it is. And then you just start to find all the things that are amiss in order to get there.
And we've seen a lot of moves towards, especially, in, I use survival horror because I think they've done just fantastic things with sound. In Dead Space, the lack of sound when you're in areas without air is very creepy, and it's meant to really evoke to you that you are in space. There is no sound. But also you have things, anytime the music stops in a survival horror game, and there, if they've done it right, there's always that moment where you realize that the music stopped at some point, but you weren't thinking about it, which is just the universal sign of something is about to go horribly, horribly wrong. And so it can really play off that psychology. But even in non-survival horror games, there's an intrinsic link between the visual and the sound. I'm going to use look at different games with dragons. There are dragons and pick your favorite 10 games with dragons. Dragons may sound somewhat different in each game, but a lot of what's going to inform how different they sound, how they, you know, their roars, things like that, are going to be how they look. We expect, you know, the kind of the sleeker, more eastern-oriented dragons to sound higher. And that's because we, not unreasonably, if you know how the mechanics of sound work, think that smaller things or thinner things should make higher pitch noises. And larger things should consequently be lower. And we need that. Because if we don't have that, things stop being believable. And so the sound has to relate to the visual, and it has to relate to every other sound in the game. And so it's really a very important important element. And we talked last week, a lot of people are going to say, oh, well, the visuals are what pull you into the game world. And that's true. But really, especially those two elements, audio and sound, exist almost inseparably together. It is a much different experience to play a game without the sound on. Even if it's a game where, like the earlier Final Fantasies or anything where you have subtitles where you can read the dialogue, it's really not the same.
No, not at all. And one of the things, I'm glad you mentioned Final Fantasy, and especially the earlier precursors, is they would use music to set the emotion of the scene.
Well, indeed, just as a quick example, in Final Fantasy VIII, the main song, the only song with vocals in it in the game, is actually a plot point, you know, this piano bar and all that. And so Final Fantasy did a lot with using the music as an element.
And I think to sort of, you can look at almost all the Final Fantasy games and look at the music as being sort of a mood setting towards it. And one of the best examples I always think of is another often used trope of our semi-pretentious thoughts is Final Fantasy X. Where the very introduction, you're introduced to these characters, the music that plays over is a very haunting, melancholy sound.
Just a piano, which is unusual for Final Fantasy. Well, not unusual, but it's associated with Umetsu's elaborate orchestral themes and to Zanarkand, the opening theme to Final Fantasy X. Yes, I know the names of all the songs in Final Fantasy X. Was just a simple solo piano theme. There is a version of it that's orchestral, but And I think it functions very well for this sort of very sparse, very barren setting while Tidus reflects over what is about to be a framing device and a flashback.
And it really sets the mood because you know something's wrong. You don't know what is wrong. And then you spend a large portion of the game uncovering that mystery. And you know that, I mean, it's already hooked you into the game just on the sound of that this is going to be a different Final Fantasy experience. It just lets you know right off the bat to expect something different.
And Final Fantasy is an interesting choice for an analysis of sound because in some ways the sound fits into the ambiance role. It's very it's there to motivate, to pump up the battles. But what's odd about Final Fantasy is it shows the interaction of games as art with elements of games as their own art. I actually got to see the music of Final Fantasy in concert here in town. And that was, on some level, it was a little bit strange because I knew why I was there. You know, I'm a gamer. I grew up with Final Fantasy. But going and dressing up in a suit and seeing people in tuxes and people much older than me who probably had no idea what Final Fantasy is, sitting down to watch what are these amazing orchestral pieces, one of the things the series is best known for, are the just these amazing orchestral works. One Winged Angel from Final Fantasy VII, Highwind from Final Fantasy VII, Man with a Machine Gun from Final Fantasy VIII, and just all of these various pieces, and seeing them sort of taken out of context, but they still worked because they were amazing pieces. And that kind of shows the interplay. They were art in their own right. How they become a work of art within the game is that they were motivated. They weren't just, okay, well, listen to this while the discs load, or listen to this while we introduce the game. Two's Anarchy was themed. It wasn't just the intro while we have some exposition narrative. It was to set up this barren landscape. Man with a Machine Gun, which is the often played by marching bands from Final Fantasy VIII, is meant to set up sort of this kinetic feel of these flashbacks with the side characters who you're trying to figure out what they are. One Winged Angel is sort of the quintessential bad guy music to represent Sephiroth. They are motivated by the game, and that's the difference. They can be certainly viewed as musical works of art, very impressive works of art, but where they really shine for those of us, the reason I feel like I have an even deeper experience with them, because for me they will always evoke the imagery of those scenes, those visuals, the gameplay elements, the mechanics of the games that they represent.
And on top of that, it's always the emotion of the scene. And one of the things that always sticks to me is the Golden Saucer in Final Fantasy VII. I can't think about the Golden Saucer without hearing the Golden Saucer music just chirping in the background, which adds a level to the absurdity and surrealness of the situation. I mean, when you think about it, it's a theme park in the middle of a desert, surrounded by monsters, and then eventually a big giant scorpion that is, like, nearly impossible to beat, but setting that aside. But you get this sort of, like, happy oasis, but when you listen to the music, there's a tone of disconnect to it, which makes you have that sense of something's just slightly off here. And another game series which always intrigues me in sound is Space Quest. And a lot of people don't think about the sound in Space Quest, but Space Quest 3 sort of marked the beginning of music as background tracks to the game. And I'm now blanking on the name, but they used an actual rock and roll artist to play from Supertramp. To set the music, because it was the first time you could have MIDIs, because sound cards have finally become prevalent in computers. Yes, there was a dark time where PC sounds were actually just chirping beeps, just like the PC booting up, for all of you under 30 who don't appreciate the suffering we did for you. And so they crafted these themes, and it set up the Space Quest theme that then ran for the entire series. And part of Space Quest 3, you end up at a place called the Monolith Burger, which is a parody of Burger King and McDonald's. But it has this really happy, upbeat, chirpy song that it's actually my phone ringtone. And when you look at the fan-made Space Quest games, almost all of them include a nod or a reference to Monolith Burger. And the Monolith Burger joke, as a joke of McDonald's, is funny, but it's not great enough to have everybody remember it, but it's the Monolith Burger theme that sticks with people, that has now become entrenched as, this is something that belongs in this series. We need to have, when we're honoring it, we need to have some reference to this piece of music and put in a Monolith Burger, which to me always kind of highlights the notion that music will stick with you. Music can play in your head. Music comes to you at odd times and has that emotional connection that sometimes art or gameplay or story just lack, because it doesn't necessarily tap into that emotional desire of people.
And you can really do a lot with background music too. Background music is often overlooked. A lot of times in reviews you'll see adequate, I forgot about it, so it was doing what it was supposed to do. It's interesting to see how different games, you kind of brought up music genre, and how you know, you could have a rock artist. You can compare, say, Ni No Kuni, which had a harmonic orchestra behind it. I want to say Tokyo, but I'm not sure about that. But obviously an orchestra. And then you have the new reboot of Devil May Cry, DMC, which was, of course, as the DMC games are wont to do, almost entirely hard rock, sort of screamo, for lack of a better term. And both worked. They worked to motivate the respect owing for, you know, this sort of whimsical tale about fantasy compared to this dystopian tale about killing demons as rapidly as possible with a huge sword. And sort of you're going for different things. And background music is very important. We've had background music since before we had vocals by a pretty wide margin. You can go through and just in the first hour or so of Final Fantasy VII, to use that, you have the opening when they're in the Mako reactor, and then, but I know the when they're getting off the train is different from even when they get into the reactor, because getting off the train is this kinetic song, or, you know, they're, as they're running through this facility, and then the facility is a much more measured pace about exploration and kind of invoking subtlety and stealth. And that's probably in the first 10 minutes, to be honest. And so right away, you get, you know, background music is used to establish kind of the tone of the scene. And it's important to doing that because nothing really changes. Ultimately, you're controlling Cloud. You're running in both. I mean, you're doing kind of this. You're running, you're fighting enemies. It's sort of your role hasn't really changed. If you actually stop and think about it, you're doing the same thing. So there has to be another way to enforce that, okay, this was you fighting through the guards and breaking in, and this is you trying to get to the location you need to be in to blow this up. And how do we communicate those differences? The visuals, steampunk, it's about the same for both. We can't really do it through visuals. That leaves you with, and we can't do it through gameplay because your character is doing the same thing in both areas. That leaves sound. And they did a good job of it.
And adding on to that, one of the interesting things to me always about Eastern games is you almost get the sense that they focus more on sound as a story device, whereas Western developers tend to add it on because it needs to be there. But there are some notable exceptions to that. I mean, id used Nine Inch Nails to help make some of their tracks in Doom. I always think Black Isle, back when it was Interplay, always used music well, and Fallout, when you hear Inkspot's Maybe playing over this post-apocalyptic wasteland and watch the power armored guards gleefully shoot the guy and hear this haunting tone of Maybe, and you sort of get the sense of hopelessness that goes into it. I mean, it really sells you on what is happening.
And Fallout would be my first example of a Western. I honestly, in Mass Effect, for the life of me, I can't remember any of the music. I kind of vaguely remember the theme that plays towards the beginning of Mass Effect 3 because there's an emotionally jarring scene there. And I kind of remember that. But otherwise, the music's pretty forgettable. They achieve their ambiance through almost exclusively dialogue. And there are walls and walls and walls and walls of text. And that's sort of always been their thing, is that they have very well-developed, they being BioWare, have very well-developed universes. I mean, you can spend hours reading about the Dragon Quest world, having nothing to do with the game. I mean, they have just... Bethesda does a lot of that, too, especially in the Elder Scrolls games. But Fallout would be, for our discussion on sound, Fallout, even the modern Fallouts, when you look at New Vegas and you look at all of... They picked all of these songs from... You know, the original lounge singers, you've got Bing Crosby, you've got some Sinatra, you've got all of these tracks that evoke the idea of Las Vegas and what Las Vegas has become. Keeping in mind that Fallout is set in sort of the what if the 50s never stopped kind of mentality. But before that, in the DC one, you had, you know, these American classics. You have Maybe, you have songs by the Inkblots, you have songs by prominent artists of the day, and even one of the most memorable sub-factions in New Vegas are the Kings, who I assume for copyright reasons they're very cagey about how they do it, but is fairly obviously a reference to Elvis Presley. And, you know, Elvis Presley has become almost deifacted. I played Final Fantasy 12 too much. Deified, not deifacted, that would be manufactured by God. Deified, and has become sort of this authority figure, this figure of worship, which of course he almost was for anyone who's old enough to, I'm not, but knowing my parents, I know at one point he was nearly worshipped. And so they call back to that, and they can do social commentary, but it's ultimately social commentary about music, about sound, about how sound, and so it's a meta comment on how sound can impact history. And it's interesting that that was in a Fallout game because they use so much real music from history. They don't, you know, really have music created for the game. They do some. There is plenty of original music in Fallout. And the original music in Fallout works very well for the post-apocalyptic westernish theme, especially in Fallout 1 and 2. But a lot of it is music that already existed, and they use it to sort of the effect of, what if this was it? What if the world ended here and mankind went back to survival rather than to making these works of art? And so Fallout can be read on one level as an exploration of the end of art. And part of that is the end of sound being frozen in place and music being frozen in place. And so sound can not only be the element, it can also be the theme.
And that even got explored within, as you mentioned, Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas. And that the music you receive is actually being played for you by a DJ who is sort of making it the soundtrack of your exploits. So they sort of play up on this notion that a lot of people have in the real world, that we listen to music and create our own soundtrack for what's going on. Anytime you get in the car, you know, I really need to listen to X.
A game that really plays with that theme, it's unique and I love it, is Bastion. For anyone who hasn't played it, essentially you have a narrator. And every action you take is narrated by this invisible character. And similarly, the soundtrack follows the exploits of your character. And it really is sort of the ultimate exploration of a motivated soundtrack, because it's very conscious, you're very conscious of the fact that you're creating the audio effects, the voiceover, and the sound by playing the game.
That's interesting. I haven't played it. I actually own it because Steam requires me to own a certain amount of games as my tithing, as Steven will get into later. But that's an interesting notion. I know Guild Wars, in part of its 6 or 7 year evolution, played with music a lot. It had a lot of orchestra-type themes early on. And then in the Eye of the North expansion pack, it added in battle music. And the battle music was basically the same tones, but it would play them louder, play them faster when you were in pitch combat, and then soften back down when you were exploring. And part of the reason why they discussed that was because they wanted to heighten the emotional state and get you invested. And a lot of times you wouldn't even notice it was happening, but you would feel the emotional investment. And I think it's really interesting when game developers kind of play on that notion of manipulating you through the music.
And it's interesting to see how things like that can transform. Certainly the battle music, again, I'm going to use Final Fantasy, started as ambiance, as, okay, the battle music is going to be faster because we want you to be at a heightened emotional state, sure. I've been playing through Final Fantasy XIV in its beta, or the re-release of Final Fantasy XIV in its beta. And what's interesting is, Final Fantasy has been going on so long, it has been a long time, and it has used the same music or variations on the same theme so long that it's almost transformed from pure ambiance to what I said about the lightsaber noise. We almost don't accept Final Fantasy anymore without some of its musical elements. There is a song for chocobos, and if you don't play that song when people are on chocobos, they will lose their minds on the internet. They will. There is a chocobo theme, and they change it every time. There are as many variations of it as there are Final Fantasies, but it's always kind of the same thing. The battle music, the victory music, and the famous, I can't sing it, I'm not going to attempt it on this show, but the famous trill that plays at the end of fights in Final Fantasy, I almost wonder if they kind of had to have that in Final Fantasy XIV. Like, it's almost stopped being a choice, because I'm not sure we would accept it anymore as a Final Fantasy game if you didn't have that. And that's kind of the power of the music, is it becomes iconic to the game. The maybe easiest representation of that from Final Fantasy is the song related to the crystals. It's had a couple of names through the years, but the scales up and down that play in various points in different Final Fantasy games. You just expect it. You expect that to be there. And you're kind of let down when it's not, I think, if you're invested in the series. And so, since Final Fantasy is ultimately about the relationships between these very different worlds, it kind of makes sense in a way, thematically, that we would get to this point. Was that what they were going for? Maybe, maybe not. But it definitely shows, at one point, this was about ambiance, and now maybe it's about theming, maybe it's about the game itself.
And adding on to that and twisting it a little bit, space shooters And space simulators have almost the exact same problem, because real-world physics tell us that there shouldn't be laser sounds in space.
No.
But gamers would riot if all of a sudden you were playing Wing Commander and the sound just stopped. And it's interesting that when creators are faced with that, that they make the choice of having an in-universe explanation. And I always remember this because in, I think, Wing Commander 3 or 4, and somewhere in the fluff for the universe, they talked about that early space fighters couldn't battle unless they figured out how to pipe in sound through the helmet, so that the actual helmet the Wing Commander pilots wear generates sound so that they have context for their actions, because you as the player need context for your actions. And I mean, it's a lot like Final Fantasy in the sense that we have an expectation that something will sound a certain way, and if it doesn't, we freak out.
Yeah, the pew-pew, so to borrow an internet meme. And it's true, we wouldn't be able to handle... There is no sound. You have to vibrate something for there to be sound, okay? The lasers firing in space, it's not going to do anything. But that doesn't work. You can't do that. And for all I know, it may really be true that if we ever end up with space fighters, they may have to pipe sound into the helmets, because for some part of us, needs there to be a sound corresponding to the action. And that seems to be a thing for humanity. This didn't come from nowhere. So, I think that sound had to be there. And that is a perfect example of a sound that we simply must have to be immersed in the universe, even when it doesn't make any sense. Even when we shouldn't want that, when it actually should theoretically detract from realism, does detract from realism, we have to have it anyway, because in a superbly matrixy kind of setup, if it's perfect, we reject it. So we need the flaws, we need the comfortable half-truths to allow us to enter into the game universe. And I think that's why when you're creating art, ultimately if you're creating it to an audience, especially if you're creating commercial art, you want something that is going to be accepted. If it's rejected outright, then you haven't really accomplished anything, because no one will really experience the artwork. And so I think that's the motivation for it. I think that it needs to happen that way.
And one of the genres that always gets attacked for not having great sound or great music is first-person shooters, because a lot of times it just feels like it has to be there to fill in space. We need a gun sound so you know you fired. We need some kind of background music in there, and it often feels tacked on. But as a thought experiment, sometime you should pick up whatever your favorite first-person shooter is and play it for 30 minutes with the sound, and get engrossed, and then turn off the sound and play it for another 30 minutes and just feel how jarring that experience is, that you no longer have that sensory input. Everything else is the same. You still see the same bad guys. You still see the same crosshairs. You still have the visual cue of the flashbang from firing the pistol or the rifle or space laser pistol, whatever you're firing at the time. But without the sound, it doesn't feel right, and it just feels off. And I think when you look at it, that Steven referenced it earlier, that sometimes the music gets lost, but it's always there, and it's always comforting in a way. And sometimes it may not be a bad thing that you don't notice the music. Sometimes its job is simply there to be comforting to you, to add in a level of immersion that may not be there otherwise.
Right, but that doesn't make it unimportant. And I think where first-person shooters and third-person over-the-shoulder games shine, so they use less of music. Sometimes they use music to great effect, but as a theming element. But where they can really shine is when you are using it, especially post surround sound and things like that. When you can use it as a in player versus player games positioning mechanic. I mean, oftentimes if you're playing against real people, especially real people like me who are terrible shots, you may get a warning that someone's coming simply because they miss you, and so. Humans are very good at deducing, okay, well, if the ricochet came from over there, the gun has to have been in a direct line away from that point, because bullets fly straight, except in that one movie. And real bullets fly straight. And so I need to move away from there. And we're actually very good at adjusting to things that we think are dangerous, even when the danger isn't real. And so, in some sense, you may be at a very great disadvantage if you turn the sound off in a player versus player sort of environment, because in especially more modern first-person shooters, you may be missing some things that would inform you about positioning.
And we focused a lot on music. Let's shift it over to voice acting. How important do you think voice acting is to a game today?
Well, it's today I think it's very important because I think we've grown to expect it as a new element that's been added. Of course, voice acting is a weird one because anyone who's very old at all will remember games, and even now, indie games frequently don't actually have acting. And so on some level, I think, well, it's not necessary. Well, no, it's not necessary, but a lot of these things aren't necessary, but they enhance the experience. I have this feeling Mass Effect doesn't work without the voice acting. Never tried it, not sure, but they got a superb cast, and they really, you could tell, spent some time thinking about scripting, which is, ultimately, scripting has kind of always been in games, as long as games have had any kind of story component that involved talking to people. But now, there's a different kind of scripting that goes into when they're actual conversations, when you're going to have people saying real things. And I think that voice acting has become very important because there are subtleties to tone. It's very hard to do sarcasm in print. It can be done, but it's open to misinterpretation. Especially when you're dealing with the English language, there's just a lot of tone and inflection. You can say one thing three different ways and it'll have three very different meanings. Voice acting allows us to explore those stories instead of finding a creative way to translate around it so that people get what you actually meant. It opens us up to more natural conversation. And I think really, especially, I'm going to use Mass Effect 3 here, but you could also use Star Wars The Old Republic, an MMO that had just wild amounts of voice acting in it. You can really get a lot more out of those games when you can have these tone values to the dialogue. And I think it's become very important in the context of RPGs. And the other game type where I think it is very important that was just criticized to a certain extent are first-person games where there is any kind of squad, Rainbow Six, things like that. You're kind of expecting people to shout things and to say clear, or, you know, whatever the element requires. That, again, is enhanced greatly by the ability to have voice actors and sort of audio cues that make sense beyond a beep in your helmet.
And speaking of first-person shooters, how much different would Gears of War be if you had a different voice actor for the Coltrane? I mean, would he seem as real? Would he seem like a companion, or would he just seem there?
I think that the voice acting was vital to is often vital to establishing character and theme, and we've had it for a long time. We've had voices in games for a long time. It's just been a matter of extent. And they've always been important, but I think that it's trending even more important that we're kind of expecting that interactivity, even though it does create problems in that you can't really name your characters the way you used to, because of course they have to have a name that the other characters in the game can refer to. So it's not without its drawbacks, but I think the advantages are greater. Is there any particular element of or instance of voice acting that you thought was perfect for the game that you were playing?
I'm going to go with the original Fallout because it sort of falls into the first time that they use celebrity voices to play voice actors. So professional actors, it was one of the first times I can recall this being true. They had professional actors adding voices to the characters. So Killian in Junktown is MacGyver. And the Brotherhood of Steel is Clancy Brown, which is the Kurgan from Highlander. And that really, it added into it because it took, and Michael Dorn, which is Worf, was in Fallout 2 as the sheriff, the mutant sheriff in Broken Hills. And it really added into lines that could have been lifeless, added in a life and character to it, and in some ways added into the pop culture aspect of the game. So one of the things Fallout is famous for is making the pop culture jokes in wildly inappropriate contexts. And having famous actors appearing in is something that's happened in TV and film forever. The 1966 Batman practically invented the genre of taking well-known actors or personas and just throwing them in randomly, looking out the windows as Batman scaled up, or creating a new villain for somebody to be. Joan Collins wanted to do a show, so they created the Siren for her. And sort of Fallout taking that and making a nod back to it really added to it. One example that I can think of where it may be negative is I'm not sure I'm still sold on the voice of Tidus. As a general rule, I don't know if I actually buy that. And another example of where I buy it, I think the voice actor who played Ziggy in the Xenosaga games did a very good job of playing somebody who had a mechanical sound but added emotions to it and just sounded weary all the time. What about you, Steven?
Well, I would say it can be a little hit or miss. I think my favorite voice job of voice acting, that's a difficult question, but what I'm going to go with right now is going to be sort of a weird example, but Disgaea, the voice actor for the English version of Laharl, I thought did a very good job of a manic, nearly psychotic child who kind of sold the idea of this comical character with sort of a serious story behind them. And so I really enjoyed that one. I'm trying desperately not to use Final Fantasy as an example. If I were going to use Final Fantasy, I thought they did a good job with the voice acting in 13, insofar as 13 has its own problems, but I thought Lightning made sense. It can be hard to play a stoic female character. We don't necessarily have a reservoir of stoic female characters. You know, they can be strong. We have strong female characters, but even then they tend to be sort of out there and extroverted and, you know, very excited. Whereas Lightning wasn't. Lightning was an introvert. She was very stoic. She was sort of playing the traditional Final Fantasy leading character, but as a female. And I thought the voice acting went a long way towards establishing this very staid, very measured character. So that was also a good job. But since I'm determined not to use Final Fantasy, I'm going to use an entirely different Japanese game. Also very impressed with female Commander Shepard, the voice acting for female Commander Shepard. Both Commander Shepards were great. You hear female Commander Shepard show up again in Star Wars The Old Republic as the female soldier, and she just does a very good job at that character type. You do see that some. You see voice actors getting reused. The guy who plays the main character in Persona 4, and for anyone who just said he doesn't talk, well, he says the names of all of his personas. So he does talk. He actually talks a lot, just not sentences. Anyway, he shows up all over the place. I believe he was the main character in The Last Remnant. Terrible game, don't ever play it, but the voice acting was quite good. You start to see people, especially in the JRPG market, showing up again and again. But even in Western ones, BioWare tends to reuse a lot of their people here and there and everywhere, possible exception of Seth Green, who, as far as I'm aware, is only in Mass Effect. But I don't think he's in other BioWare games. I'm having trouble coming up with a least favorite because I'm pretty easygoing on voice acting and pretty forgiving, though occasionally there will be characters who are high-pitched and squeaky and they tend to annoy me. But I'm having trouble coming up with a good example of a character who I think the voice acting made the character worse.
I would say almost all the voice actors in Advent Children made the Final Fantasy characters, seven characters, worse.
See, I was not thrilled. That is true. I thought in general the game Kingdom Hearts had excellent voice acting. They used a lot of celebrities, which was awkward, but generally they did a good job. In Kingdom Hearts 2, I believe, God help me if I'm wrong, but I believe Mandy Moore was Ares in Kingdom Hearts, and I thought she did a very adequate job of being Ares in Kingdom Hearts, or Aerith. In Kingdom Hearts 2, they had someone else who I thought was wooden, deadpan, and terrible. So I'd actually forgotten about the Kingdom Hearts voice actors. The ones they changed were often not nearly as good. Also, I feel like Cid in Kingdom Hearts was some weird Western parody that didn't make any sense. Wasn't thrilled with that one either. So there was some weirdness. It's hard when you have these characters that didn't speak originally that are super well established. Like, everyone knows in their head how Cloud Strife sounds. The problem is, may not all have the same idea. And so there, I think there is, when you're using characters like that, an added level of complexity of coming up with voice actors that everyone is sort of going to accept as a matter of course.
And one thing that I can hear the internet screaming at us, and I feel remiss that neither one of us actually missed this, and we may have to turn in our nerd card, is GLaDOS is entirely sold on the voice acting.
Yes.
And I think in some regards, it's incredible how well they developed the GLaDOS character, who you never see until the very end of the game. And at the end of the game, the movements with the voice acting make it seem far more realistic. And maybe I'm messed up in the head for this, but you get a sympathy for GLaDOS that she's confined in this space, but her personality yearns to be elsewhere.
Well, that, yeah, no, I'll, the thing that I really like about Portal 2 is that I think they almost tease the audience with the fact that it doesn't, GLaDOS is a disembodied voice through most of Portal, and through the earlier parts of Portal 2, but then, and if for some reason you haven't played Portal 2 beyond being ashamed of yourself, don't listen to maybe the next 15 seconds of this, they turn her into a potato, and it still works, because GLaDOS, the whole point was GLaDOS can kind of work as a disembodied voice. Yes, I thought, and that's very true, the way the robot moves matches the voice almost perfectly. And there's a great interplay between the kinetics of GLaDOS and the voice of GLaDOS. But a lot of it is the humor, and all. It doesn't really matter if GLaDOS is a potato or a disembodied voice or a turret or whatever GLaDOS is. It was the writing and the voice acting that sold the character to the audience long before you could see GLaDOS. And that's why all sound is very, very important. Portal has a kind of an industrial techno track to it that works very well thematically as well. Portal was a good game for sort of an exploration of sound, since the whole thing feels sort of like they're playing with different video game concepts. How far can we push things, physics, the gameplay elements, but also the sound. Creating a character, an antagonist. The concept of the unseen antagonist isn't new. Final Fantasy is famous for it. You very rarely see the antagonist, but for flashes throughout the game. But a omnipresent unseen antagonist, that's not as common, and they did an excellent job, and that's almost entirely through sound.
And the first hints that you have that GLaDOS isn't really helping you all come through the sound. I mean, it's early on in the hints of it, and you're always left wondering, or at least I was, is she lonely? Is she just crazy? Is she immature? Is she wise beyond her years? Does she live in the absurdity? Does she still grappling with, you know, what is her station in life? And it's always unanswered, and I always found that to be kind of interesting about the GLaDOS character. Turning to a quick sort of one-shot questions, I'm going to ask you voice actors and roles and just get your thoughts on it. So I know you happen to be a big fan of Kate Mulgrew, so we'll start with that. She actually plays the evil dragon in Dragon Age. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, she was perfect for that, but I'm a huge Voyager fan anyway, so yeah, get over it, Internet. I like Voyager. But she was really good in that role, and her role in Dragon's Age and Dragon's Age 2 is very different. And she kind of makes both work. I think that she might have trouble in other roles. She kind of needs to be that wizened character. That's just sort of who she is. And so I think a lot of celebrity voice actors, I think it would be hard for Seth Green, who I think is an excellent actor, and he's, of course, probably most famous for Family Guy, but watching him on Robot Chicken, the guy, you know, does a lot of different voices, and yet I think he has trouble with not silly. And so I think a lot of times, you'll see this in the visuals of characters too, when you have a famous voice actor, the character's always going to look, sometimes even when you don't, character's always going to look a little bit like the actor. Joker from Mass Effect looks a little bit like Seth Green. And that part of that is, again, even on a subconscious instinctual level, we associate voices with a certain appearance. And so you kind of can't get too far away, because it becomes jarring if the person doesn't look like they match the voice. And so it looks a lot like Joker. I think he would have trouble with a character that didn't have... Joker has some wry humor to him. He has some deadpan. And that's sort of what I see Seth Green doing. A lot of times when you use sort of the... another good example, the character who plays more animation, but it's a video game too because of Poker Night 2, Brock Sampson from the Venture Brothers. I'm terrible with names, but he plays Joe in Family Guy.
Patrick Wahlberg.
Thank you, Patrick Wahlberg. Does a lot. Most of his characters are actually pretty similar. And Joe's a cop, Brock Sampson's a bodyguard, the Tick was a superhero. He kind of does... that guy. And so I think that they kind of have roles, especially when they've sort of made it. Now, you don't see that as much with there is a class of actor who they are kind of all over the board, but they tend to be people who I'm going to use the old school, you know, Walt Disney era voice actors who did Seth MacFarlane, I guess, would be kind of the modern example, who can do 30 different voices, all of which are very distinct. You see that in video games. You see it actually a lot where you'll hear, you know, you'll actually find out that someone played various voices. So there are people who kind of transcend roles, and a lot of times you'll see they come from a cartoon background. But I think that where the actors shine is when you have the right role for them, they're typically perfect for it. I mean, they typically sell that role because it harkens back to their previous parts and other things. And so you really can kind of get the full impact of their acting experience in that role.
What about Mark Hamill as Blair from Wing Commander 3, 4, and Prophecy? And then Mark Hamill as the Joker in Arkham Asylum.
See, he's a strange cat in that I almost can't deal with the Joker when it's not Mark Hamill. He's the perfect Joker. I love his voice for the Joker.
Well, let me ask you this. If I would have told you before you ever heard it that Mark Hamill plays the best Joker, would you believe me?
No, absolutely not. And that's why he is a strange cat, because while he doesn't do too many roles, he seems to be in that realm, kind of more on the Seth MacFarlane side, where he can do maybe not a ton of different ones, but he's got at least two that are just weirdly different. And I would, if you said, oh yeah, Luke Skywalker plays the Joker in the, you know, and he's so good. And it's for that particular role, it would make me nervous to be alone in a room with him, because people who I think do an excellent job of playing the Joker are probably not stable. But, you know, maybe he just is that good. I don't know. But he's just perfect for that. So kind of to a modification on that same question, do you ever think that celebrities are miscast in, thinking of the Wing Commander movie here, which was suboptimal, do you ever think that celebrities are miscast and that it kind of takes away from the experience?
Yes, but my example is not because I dislike them and I think they should always have more work. But the Stephen Bloom, who's the voice actor for Spike, literally doesn't have to be in every single thing ever. And the fact that he was a companion in The Old Republic and he sounds just like Spike always kills me, because it's like, oh, that's Spike. And I'm always like, oh, I'm hearing Spike. Oh, good, Spike. And it makes me sometimes forget that the character's not really Spike, because Spike has a very limited and set defined traits. But his voice is so distinctive that way that sometimes it sort of overrides the feeling I'm supposed to get from that character. But sometimes it's played up well. Like,
that's, yeah, I believe that's supposed to be. Andronicus Revel, I want to say, is the character he plays, yes, in the game. And companion, if you can't, because there are a lot of companions in that game. Sith Inquisitor, I believe he's a, yes, companion for the Sith Inquisitor. And he is in everything. I mean, that guy. And he can do other voices, but he does that voice a lot. And I think that's an excellent example. There are times that I can't separate the character from the body of work, and that can become a problem. Which is why I think the higher, especially when you get into the higher level of celebrity, people who are very well known, you don't necessarily want them in too many things, because you're not going to be able to sell the role very well.
And my one closing thought on this is something to think about. Is that almost every person on this planet, whether they like video games or don't like video games, the one thing that they will come to more often than not when you mention video games is the Mario Brothers theme song.
It's an important piece of work that is historically important, which is sort of bizarre in its own way, but it really is. It's well known, and it evokes exactly what it's meant to evoke. It kind of functioned very well as what it was supposed to be. You know about that game. And a lot of the old games have that. You know, the sound that Pac-Man makes when he dies was referenced in Futurama, 20 years after Pac-Man came out? But everyone knew what it was, even people who were too old or too young to have ever really played Pac-Man. And so that really kind of sums up the importance of sound. It's often underappreciated. With very few exceptions, you have no idea who's behind the sound. but it is absolutely vital to the overall presentation of the game, and especially the game as art, because while sound can be its own artistic form, it really interplays with the other elements in a video game to make that game experience complete.
And so, kind of closing the book on that and turning to our short topics, this week Massively ran an article on what is called their soapbox feature, which is basically just different rants about MMOs. And this week there's an interesting article where somebody ranted about whether we should stop raiding and going and experience life more. And needless to say, the backlash was immediate and loud. And it does raise to me some interesting questions that the article, while not particularly well written in my opinion, sort of skirted around the more interesting issues to make sort of the more blasé points of like, well, you know, you should experience life and not be behind a computer. But to me, the interesting question is one of the things as gamers we always, or at least I always feel like I have in my daily interactions, I often don't tell people I play video games because they pass a set of judgments on you, some of which are largely true for me and some of which, you know, are still largely true for me. But one of the things that really struck me is one of the things we fight about is the notion that when you play a video game, you can still make connections to people. And I think that's the point the author missed and a lot of people miss. And what I found, it's not even offensive is the right word, but I found interesting is somebody who claims to play video games sort of has already accepted the notion that if you're raiding with people you meet on the internet, they're not really your friends because they're not really real is sort of the implication. But, you know, are you going to tell your grandkids, you know, I beat the Lich King and WoW the first day on the server? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, is it really any different than saying, well, I scored a touchdown in a high school football game? I mean, they're both meaningless in the larger scale of events, but they more shape who you are as a person, that you would persevere and you would triumph in some kind of setting. So my thought is more that we shouldn't be angry at him for writing this article. What we should be angry about is the fact that maybe we as gamers don't do enough to convey to people that you can form emotional connections, that you can have bonding experiences with your fellow man or woman or child or whoever through video games. You can have it. There's no difference between playing Monopoly or playing Mario Party. There's no difference between raiding and WoW with a set group of friends or going to go see a movie with a set group of friends. I mean, these are interchangeable experiences where we share common culture with somebody else. And I still think that there's a value to that, and that's something that needs to be addressed more.
My problem with the article is a broader problem I have with journalism in general, is anytime you can summarize an article with one trite aphorism, the article wasn't worth writing. And if your entire article is all things in moderation, okay, just say that, move on with life. Because that's what it comes down to. Okay, yes, you can take this to an unhealthy extreme. You really can. You can take anything to an unhealthy extreme. You could take, use another form of art. You could take writing to an unhealthy extreme. If you, never leave and experience things, then, you know, your writing will suffer from the lack of experiences. Video games are unique in that I could argue that you are experiencing things, though. So, you know, it's there are dangers to never leaving your house, in the sense that, you know, human interaction can be important. I'll leave it to each individual as to, you know, how much and in what and in what quantities. But you do need those connections, and you do need to be able to take care of yourself. And, you know, a lot of that's done in a restaurant, in the boardroom, in wherever. But as long as you're not taking it to the extreme where you're not missing out on experiences, where you're not giving up, you always give up some experiences for others, but so where you're not giving up entire classes of experiences, or you're not giving up entire things that will allow you to take care of yourself or your own mental well-being, as long as you are taking care of business, so to speak, one hobby is largely interchangeable with another. Now, there are health repercussions to never standing, and so you could argue that you know, exercise may be more valuable in some sense But on the other hand, you don't want to exercise 8 hours a day, or you will accomplish very little except potentially really messing up your musculature. So it's like anything else in the world. You know, you don't want to just eat chocolate cake every day for the rest of your life, no matter how good an idea like it sounds like in the short term. You don't want to lose your job over a video game. If your job is playing video games, then lucky you. But at the same time, to say, oh, well, you know, this is, I really was bothered by the, are you really going to tell your kids that you beat the Lich King? Like, well, probably not. Am I going to tell my kid? Why would I tell my kids about any of the stuff I did with my, there's a lot of stuff from my life that I'm definitely not telling my children. I'm not telling anyone's children. So I'm not telling myself. I'd rather forget about it. I mean, to say that this is somehow a class of experience all its own has nothing to do with it being a video game. That has to be something you're doing when you're goofing around with your friends. Viewing it as separate or pretending it's somehow special is at best silly and at worst disingenuous.
And I just, it just to me fundamentally bothers me that we still live under the aura that team game playing is somehow inferior to any other team activity when it requires basically all the same skills.
But unlike NASCAR drivers, we are now recognized by the federal government as a sports group. So remember, NASCAR is not a sport. League of Legends is.
Score.
So that was a victory over the weekend. Talking about further victories for gamers, let's talk a little bit about the Steam sale. So right now is ongoing the, I guess traditional at this point, at least from the vantage point of an Aggie, the summer Steam sale. And I wanted to talk for just a second about kind of the question of digital distribution is a much larger question that we will undoubtedly have a show about eventually. But specifically about Steam and sort of the market connotations of what they're able to do with the Steam sale. First off, just as a plug, I get no money from Steam. I wish I did. But it's always a good idea if you can make it through the year to wait for the Steam sale. You're going to find a lot of stuff on sale. It's a good opportunity to pick up kind of games that get you out of your comfort zone, things you may not enjoy, but you don't want to waste a lot of money on. Because you never know, you might find something. It's like reading the first 100 pages of a book. If I can get a game for $3, I'll play it for a little bit, see what happens. So it's a good opportunity for that. And it's also really kind of highlights the advantage to having a platform like Steam. We discussed in a roundabout way some of the problems with having a single platform, in that if anything goes wrong, if you have enforced sort of enforced sorts of DRM, that can create problems. And Steam, on some level, functions as a sort of DRM. Now, you can have DRM-free games on Steam, but Steam itself has to call in at least once, and then you can play it offline. So it's a fairly an obtrusive form of DRM, but it is a form of DRM. And so it has all the requisite disadvantages that come with that. Our alternative is Origin, which is essentially a very hard DRM system. So pick your poison. But Steam really shines on these sales, and I've noticed that this year a bunch of other groups were trying to match the sales. You saw a big sales on Amazon, big sales on GOG, and so what we're seeing with Steam, I think, is where there is competition developing. This is a good thing. And that doesn't mean, oh, well, you know, what I would caution people against is becoming sort of hipstery-ish about this. Oh, well, I'm not going to use Steam because everybody uses Steam. There are advantages to everyone using something. We can chat, we can do things. Even my games I don't buy on Steam, I link through Steam. What we want to avoid is Steam being the only game in town. And so what I would like to see is multiple distribution systems with Steam being the core social component. In an ideal world, we'd be able to integrate the social components. That probably won't happen. They're all going to be proprietary and everyone's going to want you to use theirs. But Steam itself, I think these sales are a very positive thing because they really allow you to explore games as art without feeling like you spent $50 on a buggy mess of a game that was going to be completely shut down by EA's tone-deaf response to DRM. SimCity, for anyone who didn't catch the not-so-subtle reference there. I would encourage people to check it out, and not just to, it's great to go and pick up all those games on your wish list that you really wanted, that you want to spend on Steam, but I would encourage you to find, you know, $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 game that you weren't looking for, that, you know, kind of caught your eye, but you thought, oh, well, that's not my kind of game. If you're not a platformer, I recommend Rogue Legacy, a great game to sort of pick up. I'm terrible at it, and I mean really terrible. Like, you think I'm joking. I'm not. I am bad. But it's a lot of fun to sort of play with a new game type. If you, I wanted to mention Civ, actually, and the sound thing, because Civ is also known for having a lot of a very multicultural soundtrack. New Civ out there, if you, you can pick up Civ 5 for the core version for very cheaply right now. If you've never played a turn-based strategy game, if you like kind of the tactical aspects of when do I need to capture the flag in the battlefield games, 2142 is what I was thinking of there. You might actually enjoy a turn-based strategy game where you're capturing resources by building cities next to them. And I think getting out of that comfort zone and sort of messing around with other things can really help show sort of the breadth of what's out there with gaming.
And I definitely echo that. And some of the choices I would have is the Age of Empires 2 high definition re-release with Steamworks integration. It was pretty fantastic, and I saw that it was on sale, and I think maybe on, you know, half off, and then Spotlight sale. And remember, if you miss a Steam sale, always at the end of the Steam sale, they're going to put the best part back on again, usually right at the end. So,
and in case you found this show after the Steam sale is over, they'll probably do it next year. And even if they don't, Steam has flash sales, and I really just encourage you, you know, because we have this medium of Steam or Amazon or GOG is fantastic. Find something outside of your comfort zone, maybe pick it up, because that's the beauty of digital distribution, is it's much lower risk to the consumer, purely because there's really not a lot of money changing hands.
And the two things about Steam that I've really noticed is I've been a Steam member since the original Orange Box, because I just bought in early to the notion of what they wanted to do, and seen it evolve from where it had basically five Valve games to now being the epicenter of PC gaming. One thing I wish they would do is do what iTunes did, which is have a non-DRM source for the content you buy. Even if I have to pay a premium for that, I'm willing to pay a few extra dollars to be able to have a completely offline copy with no DRM. And I understand for logistics reasons why that will never happen. But just something, which is basically GOG for older games, where we don't care about piracy anymore. But something like that. And now the second thing I noticed, because I don't always keep up with all the new things added to Steam, but apparently now I have an XP bar and a level of how good of a Steam player I am. So curse you, Valve, for creating a Steam metagame, which is literally pay to win. Sorry.
It is the definition of pay to win. And honestly, I'm not thrilled about the card system. I think the whole thing is pretty goofy. But it feels like someone thought, we're going to make a marketing ploy and we're so big we don't have to disguise the fact that this is a marketing ploy. And that annoys me. So Valve, if you're listening, just knock it off. That's not a thing. But hey, you know, has anyone else noticed that there are like 14 trading card games coming out over the next year? All of a sudden you can't make a game if it doesn't have cards in it?
I think they went to what is the most addictive thing that we can make, and are like, hey, we can make that electronic.
Like, Magic the Gathering was microtrans years before computers were even a thing. We can do this. And so I think part of this is Steam jumping on that. We can have Steam cards, and we can make a cut of every 25-cent card sale on Steam. No, not a fan of that. They need to knock that off. But aside from that, I generally have a pretty positive outlook of Steam, and I think it's really great. It and GOG are my two go-tos, since I loathe Origin with the fiery passion of a thousand burning suns. But for really kind of getting out there, I hated survival horror games most of my life. I was terrible at Resident Evil. Picked up Bioshock at one point when it was like $5 because someone told me it was a futuristic retelling of Ayn Rand, and I kind of wanted to see how that would work out. And then from there, I ended up picking up Bioshock 2, Infinite, the Dead Space games, went back and replayed Resident Evils. And so, you know, you've kind of got to try things because tastes change. And it's important to kind of keep abreast of that.
And the one thing I would recommend is go through their adventure game section if you have any interest in point-and-click adventures, because almost all of them are on there now. And worth a playthrough when you can throw a couple of dollars at some indie games.
And this is GOG? Or Steam.
This is Steam. And GOG has a bunch too now. But one of the nice things about the Steam sale is a lot of the indie games go on sale, and you can toss a couple of dollars at an experience you may or may not enjoy, which is how I acquired Braid. And I'm still not entirely sure if I actually enjoyed or disliked Braid.
And we'll talk about Greenlight in its own show, but Steam has also obviously got pretty big implications for the indie market. It and Kickstarter, I would say, are probably the two most significant forces in the indie market right now.
Perfect. Well, thank you for joining Steven and I for our semi-pretentious thoughts on gaming. And join us in our next podcast where we will continue to explore the art of gaming and random things that amuse us or entertain us or that we wish to explore with you, the audience. Thank you very much and have a good day.